hello, hello. Here's Malanka again with another episode from Sri Aurobindo, returning to Essays, Divine and Human. About 1911, Sri Aurobindo wrote about certitudes. In the deep, there is a greater deep. In the heights, a greater height. Sooner shall man arrive at the borders of infinity than at the fullness of his own being. For that being is infinity, is God. I aspire to infinite force, infinite knowledge, infinite bliss. But can I attain it? Yes, but the nature of infinity is that it has no end. Say not, therefore, that I attain it. I become it. Only so can man attain God, by becoming God. But before attaining, he can enter into relations with Him. To enter into relations with God is yoga, the highest rapture and the noblest utility. There are relations within the compass of the humanity we have developed. These are called prayer, worship, adoration, sacrifice, thought, faith, science, philosophy. There are other relations beyond our developed capacity, but within the compass of the humanity we have yet to develop. Those are the relations that are attained by the various practices we usually call yoga. And we may not know Him as God, we may know Him as nature, our higher self, infinity, some ineffable goal. It was so that Buddha approached Him. So approaches Him the rigid Advaitin. He is accessible even to the atheist. To the materialist, He disguises Himself in matter. For the nihilist, He waits ambushed in the bosom of annihilation. Now about moksha, the pessimists have made moksha synonymous with annihilation or dissolution, but its true meaning is freedom. He who is free from bondage is free, is mukta. But the last bondage is the passion for liberation itself, which must be renounced before the soul can be perfectly free, and the last knowledge is the realization that there is none bound, none desirous of freedom, but the soul is forever and perfectly free, and that bondage is an illusion, and the liberation from bondage is an illusion. Not only are we bound, but in play. The mimic knots are of such a nature that we ourselves can, at our pleasure, undo them. Nevertheless, the bonds are many and intricate. The most difficult of all their knots is egoism, the delusion that we have an individual existence sufficient in itself, separate from the universal and only being, who is one not only beyond time, space, and causality. Not only are we all Brahman in our nature, and being, waves of one sea, but we are each of us Brahman in his entirety. For that which differentiates and limits us, nama and rupa, exists only in play and for the sake of the world drama. Whence then comes this delusion of egoism? If there is no separate existence and only Brahman is. We answer that there is separate existence but only in manifestation and not in reality. It's as if one actor could play different parts, not in succession, but at one and the same moment. Each part is he himself, one and indivisible. But each part is different from the other. Brahman extends himself in time, space, and causality, which do not condition him, but exist in him, and can at any time be changed or abolished. And in time, space, and causality, he attaches himself to many namarupas, which are merely existences in his universal being. They are real in manifestation, unreal outside manifestation. Now about man. The Shastras used the same word for man and the one divine and universal being, Purusha, as if to lay stress upon the oneness of humanity with God. Nara and Narayana are the eternal couple, who, though they are two, are one, eternally different, eternally the same. Narayana, say the scholars, is he who dwells in the waters. But I rather think it means he who is the essence and sum of all humanity. Wherever there is a man, there is Narayana, for the two cannot be separated. I think sometimes that when Christ spoke of himself as the Son of Man, he really meant the Son of the Purusha, and almost find myself imagining that Anthropos is only the clumsy Greek equivalent, the literal and ignorant translation of some Syrian word which corresponded to our Purusha. Well, be that as it may, there can be no doubt that man is full of divine possibilities. He's not merely a term in physical evolution, but himself the field of a spiritual evolution, which with him began and in him will end. It was only when man was made that the gods were satisfied. They who had rejected the animal forms cried, "Man indeed is well and wonderfully made. The higher evolution can now begin." He is like God, the sum of all other types and creatures, from the animal to the God, infinitely variable, where they are fixed, dynamic, where they, even the highest, are static, and therefore, although in the present, and in his attainment a little lower than the angels, yet in the eventuality and in his culmination considerably higher than the gods. The other, or fixed types, animals, gods, giants, titans, demigods, can rise to a higher development than their own, but they must use the human body and the terrestrial birth to effect the transition. Now a word about philosophy. The knowledge, which the man of pure intellect prefers to a more active and mundane curiosity, has in its surroundings a certain loftiness and serene detachment that cannot fail in their charm. To withdraw from contact with emotion and life, and weave a luminous, colorless, shadowless web of thought, alone and far away in the infinite azure empyrean of pure ideas, can be an enthralling pastime, fit for titans or even for gods. The ideas so found have always their value, and it is no objection to their truth that, when tested by the rude ordeal of life and experience, they go to pieces. All that inopportune disaster proves is that they are no fit guides to ordinary human conduct. For material life, which is the field of conduct, is only intellectual on its mountaintops. In the plains and valleys, ideas must undergo limitation by unideal conditions, and withstand the shock of crude sub-ideal forces. Nevertheless, conduct is a great part of our existence, and the mere metaphysical, logical, or scientific knowledge that either does not help me to act or even limits my self-manifestation through action cannot be my only concern. For God has not set me here merely to think, to philosophize, to weave metaphysical systems, to play with words and syllogisms, but to act, to love, and to know. I must act divinely so that I may become divine in being and deed. I must learn to love God not only in himself, but in all beings, in all appearances and objects, in all enjoyments, events, whether men call them good or bad, real or mythical, fortunate or calamitous, and I must know him with the same divine impartiality and completeness in order that I may come to be like him, perfect, pure, unlimited, that which all sons of man must one day be. This, I cannot help thinking, is the meaning and purpose of the Leela. It is not true that because I think I am, but rather because I think, feel, and act, and even while I'm doing any or all of these things, can transcend the thought, feeling, and action, and therefore I am. Because I manifest, I am. And because I transcend manifestation, I am. The formula is not so clear and catching as the Cartesian, but there is a fuller truth in its greater comprehensiveness. This is a good spot to pause for today. In today's episode, we'll end here, and we shall continue next week, next episode, God willing. Thank you so much for listening. May these words bring light into your life. With love, Marlenka signing off. Bye for now.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.